We are talking today with Kevin Danaher. Kevin Danaher is the co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. His articles have appeared in such publications as the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the International Herald Tribune, and the Financial Times of Zimbabwe. He is the author of numerous books, including Corporations Are Gonna Get Your Mama, Globalization and the Downsizing of the American Dream, Democratizing the Global Economy, and his latest book, which he co-authored with Jason Marks, Insurrection, Citizens' Challenges to Corporate Power. He has spoken at hundreds of universities and has been described by the New York Times as the Paul Revere of globalization's woes. Kevin Danaher, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me, and I didn't bring my horse, so the Paul Revere analogy comes short.
All right, well, we appreciate that because we don't actually have anybody that could clean that
no
up.
No room for the horse, huh?
Start out, if you would, and tell us about Global Exchange.
Yeah, we started back in 1988. There were three of us, Kirsten Moeller, who's our executive director, Medea Benjamin, my wife of 21 years, happily, I might add, and myself. And what we wanted to do was to create a quote-unquote educational organization that would go beyond just publishing reports and books and typical educational materials, because what we had experienced in our own lives was going out to various so-called third world countries, Africa, Asia, Latin America, Middle East, Caribbean, former colonial areas, and just being incredibly transformed by it emotionally as well as intellectually, and getting educated by people who were doing grassroots development, totally under the radar, literacy campaigns, women's groups, peasant groups, fair trade organizations, farmer organizations, all bottom-up, hands-on empowerment projects that you never hear about on Fox or 60 Minutes or whatever here, but we found incredibly inspiring. So on the one hand, there was the shock and dismay of the poverty and the suffering and starving children. You know, children dying from measles. The vaccine costs about a dime. There's no reason for any child to die from measles or kwashiorkor or marasmus, all these malnutrition diseases. And then on the other hand was this incredible strength and courage and dignity of these grassroots activists saying, we're not going to be daunted by this. We're going to fight it and we're going to fix it. We're going to develop a different kind of economy. So we figured that we could, in a sense, help educate and politicize Americans in the same way we were. So we set up reality tours where we take people out to third world countries with a sort of reverse Club Med approach. Get your ass off the beach and find out what's really going on. We set up stores that sell third world crafts so people can hold an object that was made by a handicapped group in Kenya and read a little tag that explains why they are using enterprise as a methodology to lift themselves up by their own bootstraps, to first create the bootstraps, because otherwise you're dependent on the Ford Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation or the largesse or generosity of some rich people. And that dependency relationship is degrading for both the recipient and the giver of the charity. And we find that fair trade and enterprise, defining free enterprise as the freedom of everyone to be enterprising, not the freedom of big corporations to just do whatever they want, it's a more liberating methodology. So we have a lot of campaigns that pressure corporations around sweatshop issues. We're very active in the fair trade movement. We've now launched campaigns to get city governments to say that when they procure goods, like San Francisco, city government buys about $600 million worth of stuff every year. So we got this sweat-free ordinance that says the vendors of, let's say, uniforms for the police or whatever have to certify it wasn't made in a sweatshop. It's relatively easy to get it passed if you build a coalition, and there's actually a local coalition here in Seattle working on the same thing. And once you get it passed, then it's the responsibility of those vendors to ensure, to give some kind of certification, no, this wasn't produced in a sweatshop. And that's kind of, the definition is kind of broadly drawn. So it puts the onus on the people who are making the money. If we, the taxpayers, are going to be given millions of dollars to companies to provide goods to the city, well, then we have every right to say how our money will be spent. So that those kinds of movements, getting control of the capital, getting control how the capital is invested, and then how the profits get reinvested, that's a key area of struggle that you can see a whole bunch of movements getting involved in, and that's one of our big focuses.
Tell us, what was the motivation in putting together your latest book, Insurrection, Citizens, Challenges to Corporate Power?
Well, we were involved in a lot of these movements to protect wildlife from corporate depredation. There's a chapter in the book about Flipper versus the WTO. You have a phenomenon of shrimp companies that use a fine mesh net that they drag for miles, and it catches everything in it, including dolphins and sea turtles. You have a phenomenon of sea turtles who are air breathers who have been around for 70, 80 million years. They predate the dinosaurs. They survived the extinction of the dinosaurs, right? This is a prehistoric animal, and we are destroying it because these shrimp companies don't want to spend $400 for what's called a turtle excluder device, a TED, which it's a grate that allows the shrimp to go through, but it catches the sea turtle and kicks it out a side door. Because they don't want to spend that money, they go to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, with a suit against the U.S. Marine Mammal Preservation Act and the Endangered Species Act, saying those are unfair restraints of free trade, saying we can't sell our shrimp in the U.S. market unless we use nets that have these turtle excluder devices. Well, these laws were laws that took decades of us activists to get passed. They go to the WTO, and the WTO says, oh, yeah, that's an unfair restraint of free trade. You American government, you have to change your law. And this is just one of many cases where U.S. law has been undermined and overturned by a body, the World Trade Organization, based in Geneva, Switzerland, that I never voted for. I never got a chance as a U.S. citizen to vote for it. When it passed Congress in 1995, most of the members of Congress, they never read the bill. They didn't know anything about the World Trade Organization. In fact, Ralph Nader offered $10,000 to anyone who would actually read the full legislation, and there was one guy who did it, and he was pro-WTO before he read it, and after he read it, he came out against it, because it's an undermining of our constitutional rights as citizens, and giving it to this body, which basically operates on the needs of transnational capital, transnational corporations. And that's the fundamental problem, is transnational capital. And that could be corporations like Exxon, or it could be, you look at Sudan, the Chinese government is supporting the human rights violating government in Sudan because they've got oil investments. The Russian government supports the government of Sudan despite the human rights violations because they want to sell weapons to the government of Sudan. So it's transnational capital. And the problem with transnational capital is it's not rooted in place. It has no patriotism to the locale. When Walmart or Home Depot come into Seattle, they are coming in on the presupposition that they can take more wealth out of Seattle than they put in. Otherwise, why would they do it? It's fundamentally a colonial relationship. It's an extractive economic model, which is why the third world is so underdeveloped, and it's why so many downtown small business sectors are being wiped out. I was up in a small town in Colorado in the Rockies recently. We're walking down the main street, and there's all these boarded up stores closed, right? Fire sale, going out of business. I said, what's going on? The guy said, oh, they set up a Walmart a couple miles out of town. It just wiped out the small business sector. So the second feature of these transnational corporations that's a big problem is the way they measure success is just growth of financial. So if you've got a forest and you cut down all the trees, it's kind of like GNP. Your GNP goes up even though you've destroyed the whole forest. Your books look really great. If you fire a bunch of workers, if you pollute a local stream but get away with it and don't have to pay, or the fine you have to pay to the government is less than the profits you made on the pollution, it all looks good when you look at a two-dimensional spreadsheet. If you calculate your success based on that strict financial bottom line, you will destroy the earth. You will destroy natural systems. And in fact, the evidence is out there. Every biological system on the face of the earth is in a state of collapse. Groundwater is being depleted and poisoned. The polar ice caps are melting. Ocean levels are rising, not so much because of the polar ice caps. I mean, that'll add a lot, but I mean, just think, water, when you warm it, it expands. So the oceans, as they get warmer, ocean levels are rising at about half an inch a year. Well, the positive side of this, the silver lining is, where are the $10 million mansions in Boca Raton and West Palm Beach and Fort Lauderdale? They're right on the beach, and they're insured to the eyeballs. So as the ocean levels rise, you're going to get New Orleans times 50 or times 100, because a lot of the most expensive real estate is right on the beach. It's right by the shoreline. I'm sure in Seattle area you've got some examples of that. This is stuff that you can't build enough dikes. You can't. There's no way you're going to engineer systems to hold back the oceans. The oceans are 70-some percent of the Earth's surface. And if you get the melting of Greenland, which is starting to happen, the West Antarctic ice sheet, not the shelf that's in the water, if that melts, it's not a big deal, but the sheet that's up on rock, the West Antarctic ice sheet is showing signs of warming and melting. It's the size of Brazil. In places, it is 7,000 feet thick. Go up in the Sierras of the Rockies to 7,000 feet and think of that being all ice and that melting and falling off into the ocean. If that happens, you get a 10 to 20 foot rise in ocean levels around the world. You get massive sections of major countries just inundated. And it's not just the poor. Is Mother Nature doesn't stop and say, oh, well, you know, I am going to only take the poor people. It's going to take the rich as well. So what you see happening now is that knowledge is starting to infiltrate into places like Munich Re and Swiss Re, which are reinsurance companies that insure the insurance companies. And in their journals, you're starting to see articles about global warming. In their policies, they're starting to say to companies, you have to show us what you're doing to limit your greenhouse gas emissions, or we're not going to insure you. You see British Petroleum saying, oh, the BP stands for Beyond Petroleum, because they're investing now in wind and solar, and Shell is investing in wind and solar, and General Electric is investing in wind and solar, because they see the way it's going to go. We have to move toward an economy that's like the honeybee economy. The honeybee doesn't hurt the flower when it makes honey. It helps the flower. William McDonough, the green architect, says the model, the industrial model, has to be take the exhaust pipe of the car, turn it back into the cab of the car, and then tell the engineers, make that okay. Or take the smokestack of the factory and put it into the home of the owner of the factory. And that's how you do it. And in fact, that already exists in some forms. A hydrogen fuel cell car, you could put the exhaust pipe into the car because all that comes out is pure water. It's sterilized water. I've seen guys drink the water coming out of the exhaust. So we're on the borderline now of a totally new economy, an economy where the process of capital accumulation is based on nature. How does nature do it? The cherry tree that throws all these blossoms out on the ground. You say, wow, isn't that wasteful? No, nature operates on a principle of abundance. Capitalism works on a principle of scarcity. The bank has the money, it's scarce, you have to pay an interest rate to get access to our money. We, the leaders, the rich, we're going to buy politicians. We have to control the system. And if you want us to invest, you got to give us some tax break to get us to invest. No, that's totally wrong. But we're already now crossing over into the boundary of a nature-based economy, biomimicry, where we look at nature and say, okay, nature has had billions of years for its beta phase to work out the bugs in the system. There's no way us humans, who maybe for 100,000 years have been sentient and upright, there's no way we're going to develop a system that's better than nature. So now there's this whole science of biomimetics, looking at how nature does it, imitating nature, and saying, let's have our process of capital accumulation be like nature. And my analogy is cow manure. Capital is like cow manure. If you concentrate it in one big pile, it stinks to high heaven. If you spread it out evenly, it makes things grow. So that's the analogy we have to work on. Capital is cow manure.
All right, but it sounds very positive that the insurance companies are beginning to catch on. But you're dealing with these behemoth transnationals that, as far as they're concerned, they want to use up whatever supplies and whatever infrastructure they have put in place prior to moving over to what citizens would like.
Right. We're going to have a huge opportunity coming up in the near future with Ford and General Motors going bankrupt. Right. They're going to go into receivership. It's pretty much I'll predict it here, okay? Mark my words. Because there's a cycle. If you look at the way Enron scaled up and then crashed, what happens is corporations issue debt. They issue bonds, corporate bonds. If the corporation's stock is rising, if the value of their stock on Wall Street is rising, they get a AAA rating, it's commercial grade, everybody invests in the bonds because it's considered good debt. They're going to pay it back because their stock is going up, the company's successful. There's an opposite cycle on the downslope of that hill where they start to falter, their profits start to go down, or they have big losses, the stock starts to go down, and then their debt gets downgraded by Standard & Poor's and Moody's, the rating systems, and it gets harder for them to raise that debt, and therefore they have to raise the interest rates that they're going to pay to you or the bank, whoever's going to buy their debt, and you get that downward cycle, and they're in that death spiral right now. And what they're doing in their propaganda is trying to blame it on healthcare of the workers, and that's a component. You know, because the unions were strong in that sector. These companies were big. They could afford, they dominated the global auto market. They could afford to sign these contracts with the unions. But that same bigness that allowed them to have unions and to sign pretty good deals with those workers also allowed them, because they were transnational, to start moving their factories to Mexico and Brazil and China. And I was just in China in July, and they're in there big time. And they would move all of their factories there if they could, because they got really talented workers who are working at about 1/20th of what you would pay workers here. And a repressive government. It's market Stalinism. You know, it's the worst of both worlds. So what we as citizens have to do, I think, is look for the opportunities. For example, one of the things we could do as a starter, real easy to do, you pass a law that says the members of Congress will wear uniforms. They are public employees like police and firefighters. They should wear uniforms. And the uniforms are going to be like NASCAR jumpsuits. And they'll have decals that the relative size of the decal is according to the amount of money they get from different corporate donors. So if your most of your money is from Exxon, you got a big Exxon or a Chevron or, you know, Enron or whoever, and you will be forced, when you are on the public payroll in your public role, you will be forced to wear that uniform. Well, that seems to me to be, if you wanted transparency, and I'd be happy to do that, you know, for the, you know, some foundation gives us money. Actually, for Global Exchange, we only get 6% of our total funding from foundations. Most of our money, even though we attack corporate power, most of our money is from enterprise, from our stores, from our tours, from selling books, from speaking fees, all that kind of stuff, because it gives us stability. But on a more serious note, the NASCAR suits, I'd love to see that. But I think one of the principles that we need to push, that we should be able to resonate this with the American public, we understand the separation of church and state. And granted, you know, the Bushites are trying to roll back. They want the Ayatollah state. I told you so. This fundamentalism that they took the fun out of. There's no more fun in fundamentalism. And we established 200 years ago the separation of church and state, and that came out of many centuries of the Holy Roman Empire, the Church of England, all this depredation and repression based on the state government and religion being the same thing, being the same power, being two meshed. So when our political system was set up a couple hundred years ago, the founders said, look, we are going to have a firewall between politics and spirituality. And that's to protect religion from government intrusion, and it's to protect government politics from being taken over by any particular religious sect. And it's worked great, and a lot of people around the world still, despite all our bad foreign policies, they love us for that invention of separation of church and state. But think, there's a deeper principle behind that, and that is that no one institution, in this case church, should control government. Government is the property of all the people. It's why our Constitution starts with the words, we the people. The word corporation does not appear in the Constitution. It's we the people. And the idea of separation of church and state was to protect the state from any institution getting control of it. Okay, so if no one institution, church, should control the state, then no one institution, corporation, should control the state. So we separate corporations and the state. And what that would mean would be end corporate welfare. Right, corporate welfare is three times the size of poor people welfare. If you take all poor people welfare, aid to families with dependent children, food stamps, housing assistance, all that, and you add it all up, it's about a third of what the corporations get. Things like hundreds of millions of dollars to pave roads into the national forests, our forests, so the lumber companies can get in there, Weyerhaeuser, ring a bell, and cut down our trees at below market prices. Free market? That's not the free market. You get this incredible contradiction between the words that come out of these people's mouths and the actual policies that they implement. So you got all this massive corporate welfare. You got a revolving door of personnel where somebody like Dick Cheney is Secretary of Defense. Then he goes out of government and he goes to work for Halliburton. They get massive government contracts. Then he goes into government again as vice president, and they get even more massive government contracts. The guy that replaces him was former head of the Army Corps of Engineers. And you see this revolving door where these people are trading on their job status for we the people, working for we the taxpaying public, and then they take that Rolodex, if they still use Rolodexes anymore, and they take that out into the public sphere and use it. You have cases where a person overseeing a particular weapons program in the Pentagon goes to work for Boeing or whoever the company is that's making that weapon system, and then goes back and does the deal with their former colleagues that they used to hang out with and have drinks with. That's just stupid. I mean, that's asking for trouble. We see it in San Francisco in a structural way. Our bus system, which is called Muni, the person who runs it gets paid about $160,000 a year and a car. They give him a car as part of his pay. How about giving him a bus pass? You know, you don't give him a car if he's running the bus system. That's idiotic on the face of it, because what you're doing is you're interrupting the feedback loop. So what we're saying here in this case of the revolving door of personnel is you want to interrupt that feedback between the corporate sector and the government sector, because the government is supposed to be a servant of we the people, not the corporations. And there's all sorts of things you could do in terms of financing. Look at what's going on now with all this Jack Abramoff financial corruption scandal. If you look at the federal statutes, the federal bribery statutes, they're very broad. It says anything of value given to any public official with the intent of influencing a public act, or any government official who receives anything of value, and it's very broad, the language, anything of value, 15 years in jail and three times the value of whatever it was that transacted. If that federal criminal statute were enforced, every member of Congress would be in jail. Pretty much every, there might be a few who would escape the net. The laws that are on the books are not being enforced. And you can go, you can look it up, federal criminal statutes, and it's like Title 18 or something. I have it somewhere in my notes. But it's not being enforced. So what we've had happen over a couple hundred years is a gradual takeover of our government by the corporations, and now we need to take it back. And there are all sorts of groups that are out there, Public Citizen in Washington, Global Exchange in San Francisco, working to try to pry the fingers of the corporate sector off of our government, because it is our government. Bush lives in public housing. People don't realize this. We own the White House. He doesn't own it. We own it. And we are supposed to own the system. And instead of people having that attitude of we, the citizens, run this country, we own it, and any government official is beholden to us, because the fundamental principle of our political system when it was first established was that sovereignty, ultimate political power, does not reside in government. Government is a derivative institution, and it derives its authority from we the people, from the informed consent of the governed. It's why Thomas Jefferson, of all the quotes that are chiseled in the Jefferson Memorial, the one that's up in the top, the highest quote up inside the inside of the rotunda, he says, "On the altar of God, I pledge undying hostility to any government restriction on the free minds of the people." Because the free minds of the people were to be the bedrock of democracy. And we've forgotten that. We've forgotten that we are supposed to be a self-governing citizenry, and we have abdicated authority to these corporations to define what we eat and what we think and what we wear and what we consider legitimate entertainment and how to vote and all. And we've got to take that back, or our country's going down the tubes. We can see it happening.
One of the big hurdles that citizens have to deal with in going up against the corporations is the control of the media, which the corporations seem to have a vice grip on. Do you see success stories in challenging that?
Yeah, look at the contrast between Fox. You know, let's take 100 people and have them have a steady diet of the Fox News channel, fair and balanced, quote unquote. And we'll take another 100 people, and these are just people we pick at random, and the only news they'll get is Amy Goodman, Democracy Now. And those, David Barsamian's alternative radio, free speech news, those kind of outlets. And at the end of a few weeks or a few months, we'll test them. And we'll see who can find a rack on a blank map of the world and who can tell us about the relationship between the Bush administration and the government of Uzbekistan, where the government was slaughtering people in the streets and torturing human rights activists, and the Bush administration that says it overthrew Saddam Hussein because of his human rights violations had no problems with the government of Uzbekistan because of all the natural gas supplies there that they want to get access to. Horrible dictatorship. Bush administration was in there building military bases, giving them money, giving them all sorts of aid, helping U.S. oil companies get in and get contracts for the natural gas. They eventually actually got tossed out, not because they pressured them on human rights violations, but because Putin and Russia said, look, we'll do a really good gas deal with you, but you got to throw the Americans out. You know, this is Putin, the guy who Bush looked into his soul and saw a really good guy. You know, how many people would understand what's going on in the world if we gave them the corporate media versus the alternative media? So we're at a very interesting place where more and more people now are realizing that the commercial media, the main product is not the tires and toothpaste. The main product is you and me. It's our minds, it's our brains, it's our eyeballs, our attention. Because where the money comes from, Steve Bochco, the guy who has produced, you know, Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue and a whole bunch of other shows on TV, he says, television, commercial television, it is not an information medium. It is not an entertainment medium. It is a commercial medium. It exists to make money. And the way they make their money is they go to the corporations and say, we want you to buy advertising, and it's going to cost you this much for this much time, and we will deliver you this many human brains for you to influence. That's how they make their money. You don't put money in your TV. You don't buy things, well, unless you go to the shopping channel or something. Where they get their revenue is selling us to the commercial advertisers. So think, most Americans, and this is changing, luckily, through a lot of educational efforts of groups like Global Exchange and a lot of other groups, most people think that we are the consumers and the products being marketed are the tires and toothpaste that's in the ads. It's exactly the reverse. We are the product being marketed, and it's the corporate advertisers that are the consumers. So there is consumer sovereignty, but not for us as consumers. Plus, think, we need to redefine this. Defining ourselves as consumers, that's like defining yourself as a bowler. You know, yeah, you bowl on the weekends or on Tuesday night with your league from the union or something like that, but you don't define yourself as a bowler unless you're a professional bowler, and that's like, what, 0.001% of the population. You're a consumer maybe half an hour a day if you're a big shopper, an hour or two a day. You are a citizen 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, from the moment you are born till the moment you die. You are a citizen. Your worker 8 hours a day, your consumer an hour or two a day. You know, you have these other roles that you play, but you are a citizen 100% of your lifetime. And a lot of us don't even think of ourselves as citizens. Half the population in America does not bother to vote in the major presidential year elections. In the off-year elections, local elections, you get maybe 20, 30% of people participating. So this is the contradiction of the empire. We live in an empire. We are 4% of the world's people consuming 25% of the world's resources. And that's why we have 300 major military bases all around the world. Dozens of military bases in Japan. Japan? What the hell are we protecting Japan from? You know, where we got rapes of Japanese girls by U.S. service people. We got bases all over Germany. You know, that was set up to fight the Soviet Union. There's no more communism in the Soviet Union. But it's an industry. It's a lot of big companies selling a lot of weaponry. And when you look down the list of Pentagon contractors, it's not just weaponry. It's Kellogg's and, you know, cereal companies and boot companies and clothing sweatshop companies and all, because it's a lot of money. So now we've created this massive trough, almost $500 billion a year, that all these corporations are feeding at. So there's an interest in having a big war machine. And then that allows us to invade countries like Iraq, which just happens to have the second largest oil reserves in the world. But our leaders tell us, oh, there's no connection. Oh, yeah, so if the major export of Iraq were broccoli, we would have invaded there? No, I don't think so. So more and more people now are waking up to these facts because the reality is so stark. You know, Bush allowing the NSA, the National Security Administration, to National Security Agency, to tap our cell phones and to listen to our phone conversations. That's a violation of the Constitution, right? Torturing, allowing torture. Again, a violation. They've killed American citizens. They rocketed with a CIA drone a car in Yemen, and there was a U.S. citizen in that car. Is it constitutional for the U.S. government to kill a U.S. citizen with no trial? I think it's bad enough if there is a trial, you know, capital punishment. The notion that you're going to teach people killing is bad by killing? It's the parent that hits the kid and says, don't hit. You know, what? That doesn't work. You know, there's a flaw in that logic. So we've got the contradictions now of abusive government and abusive corporate power at such a level. Don't forget the Ken Lay Enron trial is going to start soon. That's going to bring out all the muck again. So it's getting harder and harder for the public to keep up the blinders and say, I don't see any problem. Just give me enough drugs, booze, and TV, and I'll ignore all this. So we're finding it easier to get people involved in public activism campaigns and corporate accountability campaigns, environmental, social justice campaigns. Look, right here in Seattle, back in 99, we shut down the WTO with a largely nonviolent, 99% of the crowd was strictly nonviolent. The media covered the window breaking, but the majority of the crowd was nonviolent, and we shut them down simply by putting enough people out in the street. A couple years later in Cancun, we stopped them again and again. It was putting enough people out in the street saying, no, you will not make rules for the global economy in favor of a few corporations without we, the people, having a seat at the table and having a voice in the drafting of the rules. What the WTO is doing is writing a constitution for the entire planet. And that constitution is going to undermine our constitution and every other national constitution and local law. They want to make it impossible for you, citizens of Seattle, to say, in our school system, we're going to have organic food from local farms. That seems like it makes sense to me. A lot of school systems are doing that. Helps the local farms. It's good for the kids' health. Keeps money in the local economy. Creates more jobs. Win, win, win all the way around. WTO is going to try and make that illegal. And I'm ready for that fight, baby. I want to see them try and do that. Because what's happening around the country is people are passing local ordinances. There's a great website called New Rules. It's N-E-W-R-U-L-E-S, newrules.org. I mention it in all my talks because it's such a great site. It's done by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And what they do is they compile all these examples from around the country of citizens getting together and saying, okay, we're going to have a rule that corporate agribusiness can't buy our farms, that we're going to save the family farms, and we're going to put a cap on the size of a farm that a corporation can buy, or we're going to have an anti-sweatshop ordinance, or we're going to have an ordinance that says when we buy police uniforms or firefighter uniforms, it has to be organic cotton so that we don't get skin cancer for our workers, because then that's on the city health budget. And just from a fiscal standpoint, it's bad business. Or we're going to take all the soda pop out of the vending machines in the schools because we know it's bad for our kids' nutrition. All sorts of proliferating rules around local people controlling their local economy. It's like a cottage industry. And what New Rules does is it consolidates it so that you in Seattle can see, oh, here's the thing they did in Burlington, Vermont that we could do here. What a great idea. So it's cross-fertilization of grassroots democracy.
For those of you just tuning in, we are talking with Kevin Danaher. Kevin Danaher is the co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange and author of Insurrection: Citizen Challenges to Corporate Power. So how do we get your average person involved in this? I think a lot of this stuff you look at, and I think in terms of, let's say, activists, they are hip to what is going on, and that's an ever-expanding group of people. But I still have a lot of friends who are kind of with me with the ideas, but to motivate them to action is an incredible hurdle. So how do we deal with that?
Yeah, my dad was an illiterate Irish peasant, but he was a very wise man, and he used to say, talk is cheap. Anybody can stand up and say, I'm a Christian, I'm a Marxist, I'm a this, I'm a that. By their deeds ye shall know them. You know, let me see you walk your talk, right? Because talk is cheap. What we try to do at Global Exchange, and if you go to the Global Exchange website, globalexchange.org, just like it sounds, globalexchange.org, you'll see all sorts of things you can do. Easy things to get involved. For example, fair trade certified coffee. Any coffee vendor that you go to, Starbucks, Seattle's Best, whatever, local place, mom-and-pop store. You go to them and you say, excuse me, do you have fair trade certified beans? Not free trade, fair trade. And it's a very simple label. It's a little rectangular label, and it's got a little black and white stick figure holding scales of justice, and it says fair trade certified. Fair trade at the top and certified at the bottom. If you don't see that seal, then you have no way of knowing if those farmers who grew the beans got treated right and got a decent price. If you do see it, it means they got about three or four times the market price. The way the fair trade system works, it's all nonprofits. It started decades ago. The one for the U.S., each country has one nonprofit fair trade certifying organization that controls the labeling and the contracting with the coffee vendors. And they pay, the coffee vendors pay, 10 cents a pound, like a tax, in order to get that seal. And that's and then they have to buy from the farmers that are part of the fair trade network. And there's probably like about a million farms that are part of this now. It's been growing rapidly because for you, the farmer, hey, a tripling of your income? I'd love to have a tripling of my lousy income. Who wouldn't? But it also gives them help going organic. It's almost all organic. They get a premium when they go organic. It's a set floor price. So if the world market price goes below $1.26 a pound, they still get $1.26 a pound. And lately, in recent years, the world price has been like 50, 60 cents a pound, 40 cents a pound. There are places in Central America where people have gotten as low as 7 cents a pound. Because if you're a farmer out in the boonies and the guy comes out with the truck and he says, I'll give you 10 cents a pound. And you say, well, wait, I heard on the radio that it's selling for 40 cents a pound. He says, yeah, well, then sell your coffee to the radio. I'm here with the truck. Do you want to sell your beans or not? The guy doesn't even have a donkey. How's he going to get his stuff to market? He's got to sell it to this guy who's there with the truck now, or else his family doesn't eat. And I've been on these farms. You'll see children, like 5-6-year-old kids who should be in school. They're out working all day picking beans. They don't even have shoes on because they're so poor. There's poisonous spiders and snakes and stuff like that out in that vegetation. So my question to the coffee drinker getting the $3 latte or the coffee executive, you know, who's working for Starbucks is, would you let your children work in that situation? It's just like the sweatshop chapter in our book is titled, Would You Let Your Sister Work There? Well, those women are our sisters. Those children of those coffee farmers, they are our children. My children are not the two girls that I write checks for who live in my house. It's all the children on the face of the earth. I think that's the only correct spiritual approach you can take. You know, all these people doing this, wearing their religion on their coat sleeves, we need to get them to step up to the plate about what does real spirituality mean. It means feeling empathy toward your brothers and sisters, no matter where they are on the planet. All the great spiritual teachers had some message about unity of diversity. You know, the poor, the weak, shelter the homeless, clothe the naked, feed the hungry. I don't know where these people that call themselves Christians, you know, how about the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, you know, blessed are the peacemakers. You know, he didn't say blessed are the bomb droppers, you know, blessed are the oil seizers, you know. So I think what's going on here is a struggle between two fundamentally different paradigms. And our job as activists is to be recruiters, in a sense, to make people aware of these two paradigms, of the paradigm shift, and to say, okay, look, the old paradigm was money, values, violence, God is on our side. And that goes all the way back to Columbus and Cortez and Pizarro, the conquistadores who came and slaughtered the native peoples and did slavery in Africa. They were looking for money. Gold and silver, slavery was about money, the plantations, it was all about money. They used violence, they committed genocide. The key technology was actually mounting cannons on sailing ships. That was the key pivotal technology that allowed Northwestern Europe to conquer the planet. And the third, God is on our side, you know, you can find it in the writings of the early conquerors. They're saying, we're bringing these people to Christ by killing them. I'd love to hear what Jesus would have to say about that one. But they, you know, everybody self-justifies. I had to lie to her. I didn't want to hurt her feelings, you know, that whole rap. So they have all this justification about we're bringing these people to God because they don't really know God and we're going to help them know God. The new paradigm that is now coming up from the grassroots, from this grassroots global justice movement, is not money values, it's life values, human rights and the environment, because life is sacred. Commerce is not sacred, it's just an activity. Nonviolence, you can't convince people of your position by hurting them, that's not fair. You have to convince them with logic and facts and motivation. And third, God, however you define God, the force of nature, the spirit of the universe, white guy in a robe and clouds with a beard, whatever. God does not take sides in intra-species conflicts. When gray wolves and black wolves fight, when red ants and black ants fight, the supreme being, creator of all things visible and invisible, is not going to get involved in an intra-species conflict. And so, too, with fundamentalist Christians and fundamentalist Muslims and fundamentalist Jews and fundamentalist Hindus and whoever these fundamentalists are, they are a dying breed. They are a small minority of each of their religions. If you look at whatever religion, the fundamentalists are like 5 or 10%. They're very vocal, and they're willing to blow themselves up and kill people and all, but they're a very small percentage, and they are fighting a losing cause because they're fighting against the advance of science. Their spirituality is not compatible with science. They reject science. They're fighting evolution. They think when you sacrifice yourself, you get 70 virgins in heaven, you know, all this nuttiness. Whereas our spirituality, the spirituality of the human rights, environmental, global justice movement, we love science. Our spirituality embraces science. It has no problem with science. It's Darwin's God. It's the merging of science and spirituality. If you look at the Native Americans, the Plains Indians, who relied on the buffalo, when they killed the buffalo, they would take everything and use it. The meat, the sinews for their bowstrings, the skin for their clothing and housing. And when they were done with all that, they would take the skull of the buffalo and they would put it in the soil facing east. Why east? So the spirit of the buffalo would see the sunrise in the morning. Now, the guys I grew up with in New Jersey on the streets would say, ah, that's a bunch of mumbo jumbo. It's not, because now we know scientifically that when that Native American did that act of connectedness with nature, the serotonin levels in that Native American's body went up, and serotonin is one of those health-benefiting chemicals, strengthens your immune system, creates longevity, you know, keeps you healthy, and They were putting calcium and other important minerals back into the soil to feed the grass, which feed the buffalo, which fed the Native American. So that understanding of the cycle of life and having your economic model be biomimetic, imitating nature and fitting in. It's like a surfer. You don't try and control the wave, you ride with the wave. So the surfing economy, the honeybee economy, or that Plains Indian economy is the economy of the future. And if you look at the growth rates in those sectors, in those green economy sectors, they're growing a lot faster than the nature-defying, nature-destroying economy. So we're in a transition from that old paradigm of money, values, violence, God is on our side, to life, values, nonviolence, God does not take sides in intraspecies conflicts. And we need to be conscious of that transition and recruit more people to it with easy things to do, like going into a cafe and asking for fair trade certified coffee. It doesn't cost you anything to open your mouth and ask that question. And then gradually people start to get it, and they start to see that being an active citizen, being an agitator, the center post of your washing machine that gets the dirt out, that's an agitator. It's a good thing to be an agitator. And we've got to make people see it's in your own self-interest. When I do an act of kindness to you, your serotonin levels go up, my serotonin levels go up, and anyone who observes that act of kindness, their serotonin levels go up. So it's in my self-interest to be kind to other people and to build community on this planet.
Talk briefly about one of the solutions, which is green local economies.
If you take the transnational corporation and you say, what are the two problematic features? One is that they're not rooted in place, and two is they're not green. They see a 2,000-year-old redwood tree not as a gift of the Creator that we should preserve so future generations can enjoy it. They see it as $250,000 worth of lumber on the lumber market. Cut it down. Kill it. A fish swimming has no value in that paradigm. It's only when you kill the fish and turn it into a marketable commodity. So now what people are doing is saying, okay, what's the reverse? What's the reverse of that? The reverse is locally rooted and green. Locally controlled, that is the capital accumulation process being locally controlled and being green. Community-supported agriculture. It's where you have a few dozen families contract a farmer directly. Cuts the market out of it. The farmer gets to know at planting time what the harvest price is. Market can't do that. It's not possible. A contract between you, the farmer, and us, the consumers, eliminates all that vagary up and down of the marketplace and, you know, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange and all this other stuff that people have never been on a farm and never will be and don't care about your farm. We eliminate them from the process, and we create a direct contract. School systems creating contracts with farmers or with local businesses. One of the ideas we've been pushing at Global Exchange is Buy Local Month. Buy Local Month starts the day after Thanksgiving, and it goes to New Year's. It's that Christmas shopping month. If we could get Americans to just buy, just for 1 month, the other 11 months, you can do whatever you want, okay? You want to go to Walmart and Home Depot, fine. But just during that 1 month, that Christmas month, shop at local stores. If we did that, we could bankrupt these big box stores. We wouldn't have to pass laws about them. And there are laws being passed to keep them out of their communities. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of communities have kept them out of their towns because they know what the negative effect is. But think, about 40% of annual retail comes during that month. We know because we have stores where we depend on that Christmas selling season. But we're locally rooted. We're not concerned with taking money away to some distant shareholders. We're a nonprofit. All of our money goes right back into community development work. So people are devising methodologies now to say, and you know, you can find it in the fair trade movement, you find it in the women's movement, all sorts of women's enterprises, tree planting, urban gardening projects, literacy campaigns, all of these economic models that are raising the question, two questions, the main question being, how does capital get invested? And the two subsidiary questions are, who's sitting at the table? Is it all old, rich, white males, or is it the diversity of the human race? Little Richard, the rock and roll singer, said all the races are God's bouquet. You know, let's get that ideology at the decision-making table so that everybody's represented. And in fact, if you look at San Francisco, we have a redevelopment law that if there's a redevelopment zone where the city is putting money into that community to help develop that community, you have to have a nonprofit organization represented on it. You have to have residents represented. You have to have somebody from the handicap community represented. You know, there's laws that call for democratization and diversification of the decision making. A lot of people don't realize it, but a lot of those laws are there. The second question is, what are the values that are driving the capital accumulation process? When money is going to get invested, is it about maximized profits for big corporations by turning human labor and nature into money? Or is it about meet social needs, no hungry children, no children without schools, and save the environment? Meet social needs and save the environment is a far more powerful set of values than maximize profits for corporations. So meet social needs and save the environment will eventually prevail. It has to, because as the biological systems break down and millions of people start to starve, think about when the oil runs out, even before it runs out, when it's like $500 a barrel, what happens to our industrial model of agriculture, which is totally dependent on petroleum? It runs the machinery. It's the basis of the fertilizer and all the pesticide and all that. Oh, my God. I mean, if we went around this studio, you know, the water I'm drinking is wrapped in petroleum. But now there's a company called Biota, B-I-O-T-A, that their bottled water would look just like this. It's Colorado Rocky Mountain spring water, actually, some of the best water around. And the bottle, even though it looks like this plastic bottle, it's made from corn sugar. We use it at the Green Festival. We do a big weekend event called the Green Festival where we bring together 450 green economy companies, all day-long diverse music, 12 vegetarian restaurants, 100 speakers, films, all this stuff, all in the green economy. So people get this exposure and realize, wow, the green economy actually exists right now. The website is greenfestivals.org, plural, greenfestivals.org. We do Washington, D.C. in October, mid-October, the 14th, 15th, and San Francisco, November 4th and 5th this year. And we use Biota water. They supply our water. So we take that, all that, and it doesn't go into a recycling bin. It goes into compost, the city composting system. In 2 weeks, bottles are gone. They're dissolved back into the soil because it's made from corn. So we are now at the cusp of a new kind of economy. And the profitability of that green economics is increasing, and capital is starting to shift into it. But the question of control is key. Do we want big corporations like General Electric to control it, or do we want to have it be community-controlled, local, small business? And I don't care if a small businessman is a Republican. If he's small and local, I can get access to him. I can get into his store and grab onto his jacket and say, dude, you're throwing your garbage out in the street. When Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network wanted to change Home Depot's policies around cutting virgin hardwood forests, it took them 3 years of hassling them with activism. They got the intercom codes, and they'd go, attention, Home Depot shoppers, you're... And it took 3 years of that kind of pressure to get Home Depot to say, okay, we won't cut virgin hardwoods anymore. A local store, it's a lot easier to get them to change their mind because you see them at church or the cafe or the school board meeting, or your kids go to the same school or something like that. And you go to them and you say, hey, come on, you know. And we see this in our own community where we can get the collaboration of the small business sector, the big corporations. Much harder to move. It's like those big ocean liners. It takes them a long time to turn around.
Sustainability is obviously a key issue in whatever plans citizens, people have for the planet. I'm wondering, since you have been involved in these issues for so long, a different sustainability question. How do you deal with burnout amongst individuals working on different issues?
Yeah. At an institutional level, you have to ensure that your workplace is fun. You got to have good, decent pay, especially in a place like San Francisco. People have to be able to afford to live there. You got to have a health plan. We do 100% medical dental with Kaiser, or, you know, if people want to opt out of Kaiser. I like Kaiser because it's a nonprofit, you know. When my baby was born, you don't get a bill. You know, it's a $20 copay, and it's, you know, you got thousands of dollars worth of professional expertise. But most importantly, it has to be fun. You have to enjoy it. And I think people have a misconception about social justice work and all this activism. People will say to me, oh, man, you know, you're carrying the whole world on your shoulders. You're trying to save the world. No, I'm just trying to do the right thing. If you see an old lady crossing the street in a dangerous intersection, you don't help her across the street because you expect she's going to give you money or somebody's going to see you and give you a reward or a medal. You do it because it's the right thing to do. And it turns out, we know now from biochemical science, that when you do that act of kindness, you benefit chemically. You know, all your chemical DHEA and immunoglobulin B and all these serotonin and different chemicals that are produced by the best pharmacy in the world, your own body, those all go up when you do the right thing. And everybody knows what the right thing is. Every culture in the world has some version of the golden rule. And it's not he who has the gold makes the rules. That's Wall Street's version. It's do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And everybody knows that at some level if you go out and ask people. So it's about creating a workplace and a work environment where people get to do the right thing, where they get to be on the right side. And sometimes we summarize it as we afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Because the comfortable oftentimes are buffered from feeling connected to the rest of the people in the world by their wealth. They're so busy managing their properties and their accounts and all that kind of stuff that, you know, they can get disconnected. And don't get me wrong, I have nothing against rich people. I have a lot of friends that are rich people. I would let my daughters marry a rich guy. But there are times where structurally, because of their standing way up in the class structure, they get disconnected. They don't ride the bus. They don't come to neighborhoods like 16th and Mission in San Francisco, where my office is, to see, you know, the crackheads and the people living on the street and the destitute and the lame and the halt, etc. So our job, I think, as activists and as educators is to expose people to the truth. The truth will set us free, but first it's going to piss us off, you know, and that's part of the job of a true educator and an activist is to lay it all out and say, yes, it's complicated, but we can understand it. And when you create a work environment where people get paid to do fun stuff, changing the world, with the recognition that we're not going to see the changes. I think the consciousness you need to possess is the consciousness that the masons who laid the foundation layer of those cathedrals in Europe, like in Prague, the cathedral took 400 years to build. Well, the masons who laid that foundation knew they wouldn't see the final product of their work. But they also knew that there was going to be a lot of weight come on top of their work, and they had to do very precise, solid work. So those of us who are laying the foundation layer of a future democratic, green global economy where there's not one hungry child and there's not one clear-cut forest and there's not one endangered species, we will not see that come about. But we can rest assured that our great-great-grandchildren will go, wow, man, right there at that turn of the millennium in the early 2000s, they really started to open their eyes and turn things around. And knowing that, that's good enough for me.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
It's totally my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
We've just been talking with Kevin Danaher, co-founder of Global Exchange and co-author of Insurrection, Citizen Challenges to Corporate Power.